Welcome to our Kitchen Table Talks, a podcast of the Public Engagement Initiative, Suffrage, Race, Power, Black Women Unerased.
Unerased, unerased, lift up Black women today. 100 years of pain, suffrage, and sorrow. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. It's time to honor those erased from her story. It's time to rise and take our place. In this moment, we won't be erased. Time to rise. Time to rise, stand in our power today.
I'm Gwen McKinney, creator of the SRP Unerased Initiative. Our theme song, A Black Woman's Love Song, features Latasha Brown on vocals and Glenn Pearson on piano. On this episode, join our host, Washington and former publisher Denise Rolak Barnes, with journalist Maria Inahosa and immigrant rights advocate Sayu Bashwani, for a chat inspired by this year's centennial of women's voting rights. But first, here's a Just Saying mashup featuring the insights of three political activists who explore the meaning of the term women of color.
The term women of color was created by Black women as a solidarity term of inclusiveness. It happened at the Houston 1977 Women's Conference when the Black women took what they called the Black women's agenda to Houston, but other, quote, minority women wanted to be included.
As a Native woman that has faced erasure here within California, we're not considered the real Native peoples. I have always identified through our traditional definitions, but also used the umbrella term of women of color to show that we are absolutely in solidarity with other women across those racial lines.
In 1977, we appreciated the term because it avoided that awkward use of the word minority. We were protesting that, in fact, we were not minorities, that the world's people of color are the majority of the people in the world.
When we use the term people of color, it reinforces white supremacy. And by defining people's distinct identities as nothing more than a contrast to whiteness, and it's usually a negative contrast.
And moreover, I see it being wielded largely by white people to imperfectly mask their anti-Black racism. So it is a term that has evolved.
But for people who are struggling to be seen, who are struggling to be heard, Black folk, Latinx folks, Asian folks, Native folks, it more or less signals erasure.
As a California Native woman, every day is a fight for visibility. Every day is a fight to just be seen as who we are and that we still exist here.
For me, some of the problems with the people of color term is that it erases the distinct identities, the histories, the needs and strengths of people, particularly Black people, in using that term.
And I really think every generation has the right to define the struggle on their terms. They don't have to use our language.
When you're doing electoral organizing, the goal is actually to do micro-targeting, to do messaging that will move a particular constituency that is unique to what that particular constituency's needs and ambitions are. And so glomming folks together into women of color is counterproductive in a kind of suffragist and electoral base.
We don't know what works best for all generations, but I do know that we're going to need every generation to overturn white supremacy. So no one generation has all the answers.
You just heard from Smith College professor Loretta Ross, Morningstar Gali, Director of Restoring Justice for Indigenous People, and Nat Chioki Williams, Executive Director of the Hill Snowden Foundation. I'm Denise Rolark-Barnes, publisher of The Washington Informer. I'm thrilled to be joined at our virtual kitchen table by Maria Hinojosa, author of a forthcoming memoir, Once I Was You. She's also the creator and host of NPR's Latino USA and In the Thick podcast. Also with us is Sayu Bashwani, founder and CEO of the nonprofit New American Leaders. Welcome, ladies. Sayu, I want to start with you. I'd like for you to speak to what suffrage unerased means to you, particularly in this electoral season.
Sure. Thanks for having me, first of all. And what a great way to start a conversation in such an important election year. And I'll say for me, suffrage unerased means the ability to participate in a way that is both welcoming and encouraged. And I make that distinction because I think many of us, including Black women and other women of color, have a right to participate. And when we try to exercise that right, we are called out, discouraged, uninvited from certain settings. And so the full ability to participate in a way that is welcome and encouraged is what I think the journey that many of us are fighting for.
Maria, I wanted to get you to weigh in on that as well. What does suffrage mean to you?
Well, you have to remember that I wasn't born in this country. So suffrage for me actually is something that was only given to me because I actually had to not fight for it, but I had to make a decision that I was going to go for it. And so for me, the whole experience of voting as a Mexican-born person in the United States of America, I would say maybe a couple of decades ago, that would not have been so central in my thinking. But now in this moment, being a Mexican-born woman who is able to vote means my suffrage is not erased. Both Sayu and I, as women of color in this country, and yourself, you know that this is our whole entire history is about erasure. And the notion that there's another level of erasure, which is if you weren't born in this country, there's a whole nother level of disempowerment. So for me, suffrage really ties me into all of the other women of this country in a way that's quite powerful. But also that's not a given. It's something that we have to work towards. And that's why I appreciate this particular show, because you're giving us an opportunity to give voice to this and make the invisible visible again.
I still want to stay on that subject for just a second, because as we are headed towards this election in November and looking at the whole issue of suffrage or women's voting or participation in this election, how do you see engaging women from different cultures involved in this election in November?
For me, this year, 2020, marks a really important moment in the history of immigrant participation, in particular because the representation that we have in the White House is a almost daily slap in the face to many, many communities. But as Maria was saying, for those of us who are immigrants, there's a deepened fragility about our presence in the United States that is being threatened, let's say, in a more consistent way than it has over previous decades. Not that it's never happened before, but in kind of my modern history in the United States, there has never been this level of fragility. And I say this as someone who is documented. And obviously, for those who are undocumented, they've experienced fragility their whole lives here. But speaking as someone who has the right to suffrage and has the ability to vote, even then, there's a level of fragility. Like, what else is the occupant of the White House going to take away in terms of my rights as a naturalized citizen? And so what I'm hopeful about in this election, as we're recording this show, we've already seen very high numbers of turnout in places like Georgia, where people have always had to work for their ability to exercise their right to vote. Even in places like New York, which was hard hit by coronavirus in the early weeks of its presence in our country. And there's a kind of mobilization that feels unprecedented to me in terms of recent decades. And so what I'm hoping is that we'll be able to keep up that momentum and that this momentum that we're seeing is not related necessarily to people trying to vote the occupant of the White House out. This momentum that we're seeing is people feeling frustrated about every single leader who has responded very poorly to the health and economic impact of COVID. And so in New York, we had several assembly seats that were up for grabs, where challengers unseated incumbents. And that required Herculean efforts to get voters to participate. And so I think that if we're seeing that level of turnout for local and state races, I'm very hopeful that those races, as well as the presidential election, is going to bring people out.
I don't want to leave the subject, Maria, without giving you an opportunity to add on if there's something you would like to.
What worries me now is that this notion that the United States was the world's greatest democracy, we are seeing this evaporate in front of our very eyes. And so while we may be celebrating 100 years of women having the right to vote, the truth is that it's being attacked on a daily basis right now, in this moment in the United States of America. So I'm all about celebrating and recognizing what we've achieved and what we've done. But there is something else that we have to be aware of. I mean, our entire democracy right now is being challenged in a way that many of us knew it could at one day face this challenge, and yet we were dismissed. And I think as women of color, we have always been hypersensitive, and as Sayu said, to what can be taken away. And so we're living through one of those moments right now. And that requires that each one of us, every single one of us, has something to do about it.
Thank you. And I want to go back. You used a term, Maria, a few minutes ago, women of color or people of color. And it's a term that we've adopted and somewhat accepted as identifier, replacing the concept of white and black or white and non-white. And I'm wondering how both of you all actually feel about the term people or women of color. And do you think when we use that term that we erase important aspects of our being?
Oh, thank you so much for bringing up the whole conversation around terminology and what's correct and what's not. And look, the truth is that when you think of how there's been this kind of massing together of women of color, and we're not able to hold up the very particular things that we learn from each other's history, I think this is so important because it does allow us to get to the specificity. When I'm having a bad day as an independent media journalist and entrepreneur, I will think back to, let's see, who had a bad day? Ida B. Wells. That is somebody who I then tie my own inspiration, think about Ida B. Wells, what she had to go through in order to be an independent journalist, Black woman, born in Mississippi, in Chicago. What did she have to do? Then on the other hand, I just finished writing my memoir that's going to come out in September, Once I Was You. And one of the most beautiful experiences that I think of was in the writing and the specifying of the first group of people that were excluded from coming to the United States of America. And the very first group were women, Asian women, Chinese, Japanese women. And the way the white man has written about the history, because they've been the writers of this history and the publishers of it in the history books, is that they say those women were sex workers. And so that's why they were going to be excluded first. And I realize now that my own specific experience of being brought here as a child by my mother, who wanted to be reunited with my father in Chicago, this is the experience of the Asian women who were excluded. So you're right. When we're able to get more specific, it allows us to feel more full. But to be honest with you, the whole conversation around terminology, I think, is so important. And maybe I haven't been able to focus on it specifically because of just the overwhelming sheer amount of change that we're living through. So I certainly welcome it. I think anything where we are the people who are deciding what the narrative looks like, or challenging the question, or challenging the term, or redefining, or flipping the narrative, that's the most beautiful thing that we can do in this country.
Interesting. And Sayo, you have, through your work, referred to new Americans, immigrants and migrants that step particularly into political participation. But how, through your work, have you been able to forge communities that tap into the distinct differences and realities of multiracial, multilingual, multinational constituencies? Have you been able to bring those groups together while also acknowledging their distinct differences?
I will say it's definitely a work in progress. And in this moment, we're really facing some of our own demons. What we've done is brought people together around a shared immigrant narrative. But the reality is that a Black woman's immigrant narrative is not the same as an Indian American's immigrant narrative. And there's commonalities, but to subsume all of that under the broad umbrella of the immigrant narrative has been something that I would say we've both benefited from in the sense that there is that commonality, but also I think perhaps participated in some erasure of our own. And I want to be really honest about how that has come up for us as we think more intentionally about who does participate in our trainings. How are we acknowledging the differences within the immigrant experience? Because we do often talk about the commonality, but I think we're guilty of not talking enough about the differences. And I'll say language, as Maria referred to, I mean, it's a very powerful thing. And I think the term women of color, it all depends on who's using it. When I think of women of color, I think about the full range of experiences that women who are not white women experience. But I think we have to be really careful to be vigilant about that and not subsume everyone's narrative under one. I've been reading Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider. If you'll indulge me, there's a sentence in there where she says, "Community must not mean a shedding of our differences, nor the pathetic pretense that these differences do not exist." And I do feel that the challenge with language, if it is not repeatedly revisited and if it's not repeatedly revised, it becomes sometimes problematic and dangerous for us to use it as a tool that can subsume or erase differences. On the other hand, I absolutely think that we're only going to build a successful multiracial democracy if we do come together across differences. But that unifying is very different than erasing.
Thank you. That's almost what you have to do, Maria, because in creating and hosting a show every week, Latino USA, you have to meld together a bunch of different Latinx influences and speak to these differences per se. And how do you do it? I mean, how do you know when a show is done that you have actually hit the nail on the head or when you've missed it? Do you ever have those thoughts about that as you're putting your program together?
It is a thing to suddenly be just one big group, like Latino, Latina, Latinx, a term I don't use, Hispanic. And it's just like, wait. There are a lot of particularities there. So what we do in the reporting on Latino USA is that by being very specific, we're able to help you understand the complexity of what we're dealing with. So for example, just before this recording, I was recording in our home studio because we're still pretty much participating in quarantine. So we were recording a piece about my visit in February, pre-pandemic, to the center of Mississippi, where there is a huge Guatemalan community. And people are like, okay, Guatemalan. It's like, but it's even more specific. It's Guatemalan indigenous people. And it's people who speak Mam. So now you're really drilling down and you're thinking about the fact that there are indigenous people who are speaking languages that existed before English, who are working in central Mississippi. And of course, were targeted by immigration agents at the poultry processing plants. So there's that kind of specificity of what we're living through today. Or we might deconstruct a moment in history, for example, where we are understanding something that happened historically in South Texas, and we're able to talk about the Texas Rangers, who, you know, have had a lot of television shows, but the way that they actually acted in Texas when they were first created, they were a mob, they were a militia, and they would come and they would steal the land of Mexicans in what is now South Texas. So you see how being very specific allows people to say, like, wow, okay, so We're talking about Latinos who were in Texas before Texas was Texas, and now Guatemalans who are in what we thought was a black-white dynamic. Actually, there's more complexity. The truth is that right now, we are one huge mass that has been painted by this particular president and his administration and anti-immigrant think tanks as a huge mass that is at the border trying to take over this country, and nothing could be further from the truth. And so we appreciate the specificities, but many people in this community are literally fighting for their lives post-COVID to not be deported and separated from their children and to not be attacked if they are American citizens who happen to be brown skin and Spanish speaking.
I could go on forever with this conversation because it's very eye-opening, but I'm going to have to wrap it up, and I'm going to start with you, Maria. And it goes back to the whole question of black and brown people and what are the important points of unity you think exist between black and brown people. And what consequence, if any, do you think that will have on the elections in November?
This is actually a really beautiful moment, even though it comes on the heels of such murderous moments, whether it's Ahmaud Arbery or George Floyd, the angels who, in the middle of this pandemic, and the many black trans women who were murdered in this exact time. It has pushed, in this case, Latinos and Latinas, and I think other immigrants, to really have to question, where do they land on all of this? So there is a moment of really interrogating their own anti-blackness. I grew up on the south side of Chicago in a black community. I live in Harlem by choice. I want to be here. My husband is Afro-Dominican. And so this generation, myself, my children, they are the generations of Latinos and Latinas who are going to say, we understand our historical tie to the black experience in this country. And so we stand up and actually assume that we learn from you. We are in this together. And so that is the thing that makes me more hopeful, because if this kind of horrible racism and structural inequality and the violence had not come to the fore, there is a possibility, yes, that Latinos and Latinas, I worry very much about this, could just want to integrate as fast as possible and be considered white as fast as possible. And the point is that it's not going to be that way. And so people are making choices. And I think, again, the horrors of this moment, the sadness and suffering, I think will propel people to make these choices that are actually going to be really beautiful for the future of our country. So I'm very hopeful, even though we are in very dark times.
Thank you. Sayu, tell me what you're thinking as it relates to black and brown people and the consequences for the election in November.
I think one of the challenges of living in a white supremacist culture is that many of us think of our individual stories. And I think what we've seen in the last few years is a greater sense of reckoning about how our individual challenges connect to something broader, that, oh, it's not just me. My fragility about my status is not something that I just experience for no reason. It's because we have people in power who are constantly challenging my right to be here. And then what we've seen in the last few months in particular, it's just an incredible nationwide movement of people of all backgrounds and all ages. And I think in specific answer to your question about black and brown unity, one of the areas that I've seen organizations start to pay more attention to is the relationship between mass incarceration and mass deportation. These two things are very connected, and we've often talked about the disproportionate number of black and brown men who are affected by our prison industrial complex. But I think that more immigrant rights organizations are explicitly stepping into that conversation and trying to figure out what their role is in that. Obviously, in terms of young people, every individual young person I'm connected to, either through work, or through my 14-year-old, and through my friend's 14-year-olds, every individual young person is mobilized in a way that we haven't seen before. And I think all of those things point to very hopeful signs. I'll just say that one thing that does concern me is the deep deep, deep, long-term economic impact that communities who were already fragile or individuals who were already economically fragile are going to experience. And I think people like you and Maria and me, all of us doing work that's about building a more just society, all of us women of color have to really keep organized around this, because we don't want to go back to that time where people start to fight for their own individual needs only. So yes, I'm hopeful, but I'm very cautiously hopeful that we'll all remember what it is that holds us together while recognizing, as Maria said, the specificity of our experiences, but fighting together for something that really sets us on the path for a collective future that never has to experience this level of distortion of our stories, marginalization of our concerns, and erasure of our people.
So what I hear from both of you is not only hope, but also instructive responses to where we need to go forward. So I want to thank both of you, Maria Hinojosa and Sayu Bojwani, for joining me at the kitchen table. It's been quite a stimulating discussion, and I wish you both well.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you both. We're going to close out this kitchen table talk with our Culture Pop segment. Take a listen to I Believe in Living, performed by Patty Dukes and Ref of Circa 95, based on a poem written by Asada Shakur. Enjoy.
I believe in living. I believe in the spectrum of better days and gamma people. I believe in sunshine, windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees. I believe in the magic of the hand. Infinity. I believe in life, life, life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth, sculpting mud bodies in its path. I have seen the destruction of the daylight and seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
Thanks so much for listening to Our Kitchen Table Talks, a podcast made possible by support from Craig Newmark Philanthropies, the Groundswell Fund, TD Charitable Foundation, and anonymous donors. Special thanks to vocalist Latasha Brown, pianist Glenn Pearson, producers Sonia Williams, Rosemary Neely, Tarek Ann Gross, Nicole Hayes, and Volubility Podcasting. I'm Gwen McKinney, creator of Suffrage, Race, Power, Black Women Unerased. I invite you to tune in to our next episode of our Kitchen Table Talks. And meanwhile, visit us online at srpunerased.com.